This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Hey, guess what? It's now been 1 year, 52 shows since we launched Second Look. My, how time flies. So grateful to have your company today. We'll take a look at how the sudden vacancy on the Supreme Court after Antonin Scalia's death might affect the appeal in the corruption case of former Governor Bob McDonnell. And stay tuned for this week's episode of Our Island Universe. But let's dive in first with the latest three installments of our look at refugees in Virginia and a focus on the special medical needs of asylum seekers, as well as the special challenge of helping them find work. Those who come here fleeing violence in other countries often suffer from years of poor or even non-existent medical care. WMRA's Jordy Yeager introduces us to one such patient and the doctors at the University of Virginia who focus on the special needs of asylum seekers.
Still I'm alive because of the help and the generosity of the American people and American government. Otherwise, I would have died had I not come here.
56-year-old Bimal Chetri isn't exaggerating. In all likelihood, he really would be dead if he hadn't come to Charlottesville as a refugee 2 years ago.
I came here as a kidney patient, right? So they had already fixed everything for me, for my treatment in the UVA. So from the first month only, I've been under the doctor's supervision and under treatment. So it has been more than two years I've been getting the best of the treatment, and I'm still alive. I have only 11% kidneys working.
Chetri was born in Bhutan and spent 20 years living in a refugee camp in Nepal. Today, he sits comfortably in the living room of his ground floor apartment. His wife cooks a potato dish for us in the adjacent kitchen. His granddaughter watches cartoons on the couch. Every 8 hours, he gets dialysis for kidney failure that resulted from untreated high blood pressure. He doesn't own a car, so once a month he walks the 3-mile round trip to the University of Virginia Hospital for a checkup. Chetri is one of more than 3,000 refugees who've moved to Charlottesville through the International Rescue Committee since 1998. When they arrive, the IRC directs refugees to the health department, where they get rescreened and receive the vaccinations required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're enrolled in Medicaid and referred to UVA for their health needs.
I'm Fern Houck. I'm a physician at the University of Virginia in the Department of Family Medicine.
When Dr. Houck moved here 15 years ago, refugees had to bounce all over UVA and sometimes all over town to get the care they needed. Imagine doing that in a foreign country where you don't speak or read the language. When Dr. Houck saw this, she collaborated with the IRC and the health department and created the International Family Medicine Clinic at UVA.
Basically, we agreed that we would be the primary care physicians for all the refugees who come through the IRC into Charlottesville. The thing that's unique about our program is that we don't have a separate refugee clinic. It's incorporated into our family medicine clinic at the primary care center here.
Now, this may seem trivial, but by incorporating refugees into the everyday American experience of going to see a doctor, one significant border in a country filled with linguistic, social, and cultural barriers is crossed. The International Family Medicine Clinic has more than 2,000 refugee patients. At their initial visit, Houck and her colleagues use an in-person interpreter to explain what a family physician is. Then they try to create a medical history for the patient. Some refugees, like those from Iraq and Syria, have lived in cities and had access to relatively good medical services, while others, like the Burmese and Bhutanese, have lived in refugee camps for decades where chronic diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol have likely gone undiagnosed and untreated. Doctors do hearing and vision tests, nutritional assessments. If need be, they refer refugees to a specialist or a local dentist for tooth decay, which is a huge problem. But treatment and diagnosis are a fraction of what Houck and her colleagues do.
I'd say we spend 75% plus of our time doing education. Think about the United States perhaps 30 years ago and think about where people were thinking about high blood pressure, for instance. So we really are starting from square one on so many fronts. We're explaining a lot of disorders and diseases to them. We're explaining why we need to treat them with medicine and if what happens if we don't treat them with medicine.
In many ways, patients with physical aches and pains are the easiest to care for. How do you explain ailments that patients have yet to feel? Things like heart disease or preventative treatments like mammograms and colonoscopies. Even more difficult are the unseen injuries some refugees have sustained.
We've also worked very hard on the mental health side. Mental health is a huge, huge, huge issue. We've talked about people coming from war-torn areas, being displaced from their homes, seeing people killed in front of their very eyes. Sorry.
Dr. Hauck chokes up when she thinks about the trauma some of her patients have suffered. Some female refugees have been raped or been victims of genital mutilation. Others have been physically tortured. There's no easy way to raise such traumatic and horrific events, but from a medical perspective, they need to. Studies show that depression and post-traumatic stress disorder are more common among refugees than average Americans, and if left untreated, can lead to suicide. And that's where Dr. Claudia Allen comes in.
A lot of refugees, if not all, have experienced some kind of trauma.
Allen is the director of behavioral services and family medicine at UVA and a clinical psychologist at the hospital's family stress clinic, where Hauck refers refugees with mental health needs.
A lot of people do find themselves experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Not only do mental health issues manifest as physical ailments like head or stomach aches, they also severely affect day-to-day life. Whether you're a child trying to concentrate in school or an adult trying to adapt to a new job, often refugees will experience something called hypervigilance.
You know, their brain might tell them, no, it's okay now. I'm here in Charlottesville. There's not a war going on. You know, I'm actually safe. But the other part of your brain and your kind of reactions are still very heightened. And so they might be easily startled by loud noises, or they might feel anxious around strangers.
Because gaining the trust of their patients is imperative to the mental health process, Allen aims to provide care frequently, a little at a time, over a long time. While providing refugees with physical and mental health care is challenging, both Dr. Allen and Dr. Hauck repeatedly stress that the benefits make their job enormously gratifying. They speak of the unparalleled resilience and strength they see in their refugee patients and their fortified work ethic and perseverance. Hauck's been invited to refugee weddings and adopted as an honorary family member. But perhaps the greatest joy is the prospect of seeing former patients return, not as patients, but as practitioners.
And that's been an incredibly rewarding piece, especially to see children who I've taken care of when they were 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, and now they're graduating from the University of Virginia. I have one who I just heard about from her mom that she just graduated this past year from dental school in Richmond. So that's pretty incredible. I want them to come back here and practice.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Many immigrant newcomers, including refugees, take hourly paid jobs in the service industry here, and that includes people who in their home countries were restaurant managers or engineers or lawyers. And the next two stories focus on refugees finding work. First, Jordy Yeager finds one new project in Charlottesville that helps train people for specific work with the assurance of a job at the other end.
I'm just going to mark down on the sheet right, when you say each thing. Okay, okay. I'm going to pretend like I'm the tester today.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to check first all the lights.
The morning temperature is below freezing when I meet 32-year-old Nar Gurung at the Charlottesville Area Transit Bus Depot. He and his trainer, Ken, or Mr. Kenny as the kids call him, are practicing the 45-minute pre-trip portion of the commercial driver's license test. Gurung was born in Bhutan and lived for 2 decades in the refugee camp in Nepal. But now, he's training to be a school bus driver for the city.
So, under the front of the bus, I'm going to check for the string box. So, string box should not be cracked. No missing nuts and bolts.
Gurung is one of more than 3,000 refugees who have moved to Charlottesville over the last 17 years through the International Rescue Committee's resettlement program. Housing, healthcare, school enrollment, these are all things the IRC immediately tackles when refugees first arrive. But right up there with these,
I help refugees find their first jobs when they come to Charlottesville.
Monty Hackney is an employment coordinator with the IRC in Charlottesville.
Our work is really focused on helping ensure that people get their feet on the ground and become self-sufficient as soon as possible.
Within the first week of a newcomer's arrival, the IRC develops a resettlement plan with each refugee, pinpointing the type of job he or she can realistically get. They craft a resume and discuss any long-term career goals. In their home countries, some refugees have worked as farmers, doing manual labor with little education or professional training, while others have been doctors or engineers. But these technical skills don't necessarily translate into American life, at least not immediately.
We hope to put them on a career track where they can contribute to our community with those skills. That almost never happens with their first job. You know, the first job is really about paying your rent and establishing a way to be self-sufficient financially and then build from there.
That usually means jobs in the $8 to $10 an hour range, which in Charlottesville means washing dishes at restaurants, cleaning hotel rooms at the Omni, or working as housekeepers at the Farmington Country Club. I met refugees who do all of these things, but the cost of living here is so high that just one of these jobs will often not cut it, especially if you have a family to support, which most refugees do. According to a recent report looking at Charlottesville's poverty and employment levels, a single parent with two kids would need to make at least $17.50 an hour to be able to support themselves independently. Gurung supports his wife, who is pregnant, and his two-year-old son while helping his parents as well. When he moved here in 2012, he got a job at the Boar's Head Inn. After 3 months, the IRC helped him get a better job as a housekeeper at the University of Virginia Hospital, which hires lots of refugees, starting them at $10.65 an hour. Within a year, Gurung was promoted to team leader and making $13 an hour. Clearly, Gurung was hungry to do more. In the refugee camp, he had worked as a social worker for the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees, helping suicidal and distraught refugee children. So how do refugees begin to build a career here? Some go back to school, says Hackney. They get the necessary U.S. certification in their respective fields, nursing, for example. The IRC partners with Piedmont Virginia Community College, which offers adult career coaches. And for their first 5 years, refugees have access to the state's STEP program, which stands for Skills Training for Enhanced Earnings Potential. It's geared towards English proficiency and moving refugees from a survival job to a career job. Last year, the IRC introduced Gurung to a new program the city had started called Growing Opportunities, or GO for short. The GO programs flip the traditional job model on its head. Instead of training someone in a skill and hoping to find them a job afterwards, the GO programs develop training curriculums based on the needs of specific employers in town. Then they train people with the assurance of a job at the other end. The city has graduated 7 classes since they started a year and a half ago.
The GO programs at the city have just been like a collective genius.
There's Go Electric for electricians, Go Clean for custodial services, Go CNA for certified nursing assistants, and Go Driver for bus drivers, like Gurung. The program's open to all area residents, not just refugees. But in Gurung's class of 7, 4 were from Bhutan, 1 from Afghanistan, and 2 from the U.S. For months, Gurung's been showing up for training at 7 a.m., which goes until 1 in the afternoon. He goes home, eats lunch, changes clothes, and goes to work at UVA around 5 p.m. He doesn't get home until 2 in the morning. And then he wakes up and does it all again. But it's worth it, Gurung says. Last week, he passed his road test. And pretty soon, he'll start driving actual kids on an actual bus, making $15.18 an hour.
We have to be a hard worker all the time because we don't have nothing here. So we have to struggle from the beginning itself. So if we struggle, there are lots of opportunity.
In some ways, Gurung's been training for this job since he was a kid, living in the refugee camp. He and his friends used slippers to make small buses to play with. They'd make wheels and attach a rope to pull them along a miniature road.
I used to be the bus driver by pulling the rope.
2 months ago, Gurung and his class graduated from the GO program, meaning that after 5 weeks of training, they had all passed multiple tests and received their commercial driver's license learner's permits. A small crowd of about 50 friends, family members, city employees, and area partners gathered to honor them in a ceremony downtown. Each graduate spoke about their experience and how the program had transformed their life. Gurung recalled government-conducted killings, torture, and rape that his family had fled nearly 25 years ago in Bhutan, and just how grateful he was to be here now. His peers agreed and shared their own struggles they had overcome. Afterwards, they all stood up at the front of the room, together, and joined their voices.
We are not alone. We are not alone. We are not alone today. Oh, deep in my heart, we do believe that we are not alone today.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Many refugees who wind up in the Shenandoah Valley find jobs in one of the biggest industries there, poultry processing, where lots of manual labor is required, but knowing English is not. Jesse Nadler spoke to the head of the Purdue facility in Bridgewater to get a sense of the challenges and benefits of this workforce dynamic.
Hey, Jim. Hey. This is Jesse.
Hi. First things first, Purdue's Bridgewater facility, the company's only facility in the region, is where the cooking happens. Anything from chicken nuggets, cutlets, strips, to fully cooked whole birds.
but I'm about a million and a quarter on chicken a week. And on the turkey side, I'm running about a million and a third. And I can pretty easily on the turkey side go up to about 2 million.
Director of Operations Kenny Lambert is referring to pounds. His facility produces millions and millions of pounds of cooked poultry product every week bound for grocery stores nationwide. 580 employees make it happen. 42% of them are immigrants. Other than the Harrisonburg public school system, you're not going to find a more multicultural mix than at a poultry factory.
Our countries currently are made up of Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Cuba, Colombia, Dominican Republic, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Bosnia, Russia, Kenya, and right now we have a couple people from Uganda.
Purdue doesn't break the numbers down to determine how many of those immigrants are refugees. Essentially, the company's hiring credo is, if you can do the job, you have a job. English not mandatory.
It's really just the demographics of the area. We're not singling to hire anybody specifically based on race, religion, or anything like that.
Still, working with a 42% non-Native American workforce presents its challenges, specifically language barriers between managers and employees, whom Purdue calls associates.
Now, if an associate comes to us and asks us to help them find an English as a second language, we'll find class that's suitable for the time that they have and the hours that they have, and we'll actually subsidize it.
Employees have to be with the company for at least 6 months to apply for this benefit, and classes are usually taught through the Dayton Learning Center. And it works both ways. Lambert is now fluent in Spanish and can speak some Bosnian and Russian as a result of working for Purdue. He didn't take me to see the processing area to witness where all the nationalities converge, but he did say that associates are assigned to problem-solving teams that are intentionally mixed.
We want the folks to mesh together and to become more of a family and more of a team in the processing area. We really don't want to segregate and create barriers.
There's also a common misconception that immigrants or refugees come to the United States for a higher standard of living. That's not always the case. Plenty undergo a loss of professional prestige in exchange for the relative safety of living in the United States.
We have a gentleman who is here from Cuba. He is a lead right now on a packing line, and in Cuba, he was a dentist. We also had a lady. She started off here as an hourly associate, and in Cuba, she was an architect.
White-collar professionals end up doing manual labor for the first time in their lives, which can be an adjustment.
I can remember one Saturday I came in, and we had two different cleaning chemicals in the production area. And a Bosnian guy called me over, and he wrote the equation for the two chemicals. And he solved the equation and pointed the fact that the two chemicals, when they came together, could be dangerous. And this guy was very well educated in chemistry.
Regardless of the training and skills newcomers bring with them, Lambert values the melting pot of new perspectives.
They're bright, contributing people who interact very well with the groups, the work groups, and actually have come up with some very, very ingenious ideas on ways to improve the process, either from a throughput or a safety standpoint.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Coming up this week, as our series continues, we're going to explore how faith and religion can provide some continuity for people whose lives have otherwise been upended. And we've also got to look at the special immigrant visa program, not specifically for refugees, but for people in a similar situation, often folks in war-torn countries such as Iraq and Afghanistan, who have aided U.S. personnel there and need to leave for safety reasons. Listen for all of that coming up this week. Well, over the last week, we've been following the latest on the unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia in Virginia. His death could impact an appeal of former Governor Bob McDonnell's corruption trial. Virginia Public Radio's Mallory No Pain reports on that case and one other case that Virginia lawmakers are watching closely.
Experts say former Governor Bob McDonnell lost an important ally in Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Quentin Kidd, a political scientist at Christopher Newport University, says Scalia's writings show he believed in an important distinction in cases of corruption for public officials between informal political acts, like hosting a reception, and official acts, like signing a law.
And that's the argument that, you know, in essence, that Bob McDonald's attorneys are making, is that Bob McDonald didn't engage in any official acts. All he did was do some things that were supportive of Star Scientific, but nothing that was an official act in his capacity as governor of Virginia.
The court seems more likely now to tie 4-4 on McDonald's case, meaning the lower court ruling would stand and Virginia's ex-governor would face 2 years jail time. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe.
Nicholas Copernicus, a Renaissance mathematician and astronomer, was born on February 19, 1473. His book on the revolutions of the celestial spheres, published just before his death in 1543, postulated that the sun, rather than the earth, was at the center of the solar system. While the Copernican model is often synonymous with a sun-centered geometry, he wasn't the first to suggest it. Aristarchus of Samos, some 1,800 years before Copernicus, suggested the Earth orbited the sun. During the Dark Ages, Islamic astronomers had also advocated for a sun-centered solar system. However, the intellectual climate of the time remained dominated by Aristotelian philosophy and the corresponding Ptolemaic astronomy. In fact, there appears to have been very little controversy after publication of Copernicus's book in 1543. It was not until six decades later that the Catholic Church took any official action against it. By then, Johannes Kepler had shown that perfect circles for planetary orbits, which Copernicus retained in his model, was not correct. Kepler showed that the orbits of planets must be elliptical. Soon thereafter, Galileo and his telescope appeared on the scene, and science has never been the same since. Happy birthday, Nicholas.
For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about our News and Information Fund and how we fund our local news, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at the website, too, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. You might even get us to the magic number of 2,000. That'd be pretty cool. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And you can find lots of stuff about the Refugees series with the hashtag Refugees in Virginia. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.